Rishi Dasgupta ist Arzt, Innovationsstratege und Chief Executive des Health Innovation Network South London. Tagtäglich beschäftigt er sich mit einer der wichtigsten Fragen im Gesundheitswesen. Wie schaffen wir es, dass Innovationen nicht nur entwickelt, sondern auch erfolgreich in die Versorgung gebracht werden? In dieser Folge von Visionäre der Gesundheit spricht Inga Bergen mit ihm über die größten Hürden bei der Einführung neuer Technologien, den Einsatz von künstlicher Intelligenz im Gesundheitswesen, die Skalierung erfolgreicher Startups und die Bedeutung von Daten für bessere Entscheidungen. Außerdem geht es darum, was Gesundheitssysteme in Europa voneinander lernen können und warum die eigentliche Herausforderung oft nicht die Innovation selbst, sondern ihre Umsetzung ist. Ein Hinweis vorab: Diese Folge ist auf Englisch.
So, I am super excited and welcome you all to today's episode of Visionaries of Healthcare. About my guest today, who is in London right now, Rishi Dasgupta. He's chief executive of the Health Innovation Network in South London. He has a very, very interesting background we will talk about today. And I'm super excited you'll be my guest today. Hi, Rishi.
Hi, Inga. Lovely to join you today. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I'm Rishi Dasgupta, as you said, and I'm chief exec at the Health Innovation Network based in South London. And it might be worth us starting off by a little bit about what Health Innovation Networks do and how we fit things together.
That would be interesting for us to learn. So what do you do?
Really, there are three broad areas we work in. So the first is helping innovators to develop their products and develop products that fit the market well. And the second bit is thinking, how do we get those products adopted and spread across the network and across the whole health ecosystem? And the third bit is actually a really important part of that for us in London, is that often people develop a lot of evidence for how things work in terms of the efficacy of a product. But actually, when you think about how you're going to implement it, what are the success factors for implementation? What are the health economics of that product? You know, what are the customer satisfaction around the product? It's often researched in a bit less detail. So we do quite a lot of the evaluation element of things that fit alongside that in order to make that work. And, you know, examples of that are around well, we can go a little more into depth on that later, can't we? But those three elements. And because of that, we are working primarily with a health system, which is traditional providers within the National Health Service in the UK, sometimes private providers, social care providers, who in our economy are somewhat different, but equally important. And then some providers who are thought of as a bit more niche, so like school nurses, schools providers, community health. We even have the largest prison health service in the UK is headquartered out of South London. And there are all sorts of challenges with providing health in prisons that are somewhat adjacent to the rest of healthcare. So all of those elements come into it. And what we chose to do in England about almost 15 years ago was, in thinking through how our health systems work, a lot of systems think about kind of a push model of innovation, of how do I come up with an invention and then how do I develop it to the next stage and move through to the next stage and then scale it up, which I think works quite well in pharmaceuticals, and you know, that's where we drew it from. But when we think about other types of innovation, particularly med devices, digital health, even like changes to the way that administrative processes or pathways of care work, that model of pushing things through the system is less well suited to it, I think. And in that world, I think we are in the process of moving from that model to a pull model of saying, here's what our need as a system is. Now, you know, you can kind of, in digital, you've done digital companies in the past, haven't you? It's sort of, you can kind of build anything if you know what you're aiming to build. Mm-hmm. So if the system can articulate what it needs really well, then the innovation you know, either exists somewhere in Europe or somewhere in the world, or it can be built relatively quickly through a partnership.
Yes,
so I think that's where we've seen a difference.
That is so, so interesting, because now in the age of AI, innovation is becoming so fast and healthcare is adopting so slowly, kind of. It's a fact that patients adopt AI so quickly, and we have shadow AI in the, you know, and it's just one symptom of, a system that is super slow on the one hand side, and people having a need and just using technology. So I come from the world of technology, so that's usually the use case that interests me the most. And you explained it. You see it very broadly, whom you integrate into your network, and then you try to come up with needs and try to find the innovators that you can then integrate, and you help them to build a product and to create a product accordingly. I find this so interesting because the city of London has just declared, a strategy and becoming, or wants to become, a coordinated health innovation zone. I'm thinking, why do we need a health innovation zone, and what, why is a network like that, you know, of benefit for really accelerating the speed?
I think that's a really good question. So the as you highlighted, the life sciences strategy for London was published yesterday and builds on our national strategies for life sciences and for the NHS's 10-year plan. So NHS London and the Mayor's Office have worked together to try and work out what would accelerate innovation in London in healthcare to improve, you know, the development of products, but also to help improve the health of Londoners. The Mayor's very committed to making London the healthiest global city in the very near future. So those documents are all published. Yeah, those documents are now published. I think what we've noticed is that innovation happens often at different scales. So the advantage of London is there's sort of at least one of everything somewhere in London, because it's 10 million people and has a large tech industry and has good talent and has good access to finance and good data and a health system with specialists in almost anything you can think of. The difficulty is, of course, navigating that. So, you know, there is at least one of everything, and there's probably three kinds of specialist neurologist in whichever field you want to work with. So which of them would you choose to work with if you're developing a product? And so signposting that is one of the elements of it. But we've really identified three areas we would like to improve in London. One is around the way that we finance healthcare and new products, mm-hmm. and moving often some of the new products we see cost something in year one, but then release additional value in year two, three, four, and taking a multi-year view of it is helpful. And often they release benefits in different places. So there's a lot of conversation in London at the moment and in the UK more broadly around what we're calling the left shift from treatment to prevention. And if you do more prevention, then often it's a different group of healthcare providers or a different part of the system that is benefiting in addition to the patient. You know, you may make a change in primary care that reduces the need to access secondary care, and therefore the financial benefit is in secondary care, but the cost is in primary care. So those financing issues are one of the areas that we're focusing on. The second area is around procurement. And actually, I think Germany has done very well on procuring digital pieces through DIGA. Mm-hmm. We can talk a little more about that. But some of the things we're learning from you guys. But thinking through procurement, both in terms of a model where things can diffuse quickly and move from one, proving in one place, moving to the next place and the next place and the next place with the minimum effort. And then secondly, procuring at scale, because one of the advantages of having a population of 10 million and all the providers that we have is if something is best procured at a 1 million scale, we can do that in London several times. if it's best procured at a 10 million scale for a digital platform, for example, for our genomics platforms, we can do it once across London. And so it gives us the kind of some of the agility of being a smaller environment in a city kind of scale, and some of the advantages that you would normally associate with, you know, countries around Europe. So I think putting those two together is useful. And then the third problem that the strategy is aiming to solve is around how do we share learning about the spread? Because I suspect we'll go into it in a bit more detail as well. I'm a clinician as well, and I think all of us would feel that we want to have autonomy over the way we practice, and we're responsible for safety, and ultimately the buck stops with us. Therefore, we have to have, in order to make that real, we have to retain some ability to say yes or no to particular innovations and whether we want to use them. And that often comes into a direct conflict with, well, we want to roll this out at scale across the whole the whole city or the whole country, and the simplicity that patients and rightly demand for, you know, knowing what comes next.
I think that's so interesting because, two of the three topics you mentioned are organizational and are processes, and one is actually evidence. The systems we have in place, they are too slow, as I said, for the speed of innovation that we also need. We have demographic change, we have a lack of personnel in healthcare, and the problems the NHS and the UK has are pretty much the same that we have in Germany. And you have been a doctor, you have been a strategist at McKinsey, you have been a hospital CITO, information and technology, and you have been a startup founder. And now you run an organization that probably most people outside of the NHS have never heard of.
That's true.
Yeah. And I find this so interesting because you have seen so many different angles from how well do we prevent our systems really to adopt innovation that could help to reach that bold vision. You know, making people more healthy. And we definitely need that in all the mature healthcare systems. And now you're bringing together all these perspectives, well, in order to change the system. It's real. I mean, it could be a really powerful thing if it works out in the end. I mean, London, you said it has 10 million patients. You have three of the top 15 research universities in London. You have, I think, 2,700, I looked it up, life science companies, still lots of challenges in day-to-day healthcare.
Yeah, right? And I think so. And I think I'm by nature an optimist. So I try and look at where is innovation spreading really well and really quickly. And I think that where I see it spreading very quickly is in areas where there's really good specialist care, because then you've got, you know, the patients you're seeing on a day-to-day basis, if you're an oncologist or if you're or a specialist neurologist or something like that, you're often seeing similar kinds of patients. And if an innovation comes along that affects most of your patients, you're very quick to adopt it. I think where I see it being more needing more support to spread innovations is where there is real heterogeneity of practice. So like very different ways of practicing across a specialty, or where it's really generalist areas. So, you know, in pediatrics, if there's something that affects only one in 20 of the patients that I see, then the amount of effort and bandwidth I can get to adopting a new way of doing things for that 5% of the patients is necessarily more challenging and therefore needs a bit more support. And that's where we come into things with the adoption work that we do. And then I think the other bit that I see quite a lot of is a lot of colleagues who get very excited when they see the newest, shiniest thing that is at the cutting edge. And so that's again why it gets new things get adopted quickly into specialist care. But of course, then there's quite a long way, you know, it goes from being the sprint to being the marathon to actually get that adopted everywhere for clinicians who see fewer of the patients who will benefit from that. So, you know, that long piece. So I think the talk I'm doing at Health this year is the conference is around that adoption challenge, which for me is one of the one, you know, that's why I got excited and involved in management was actually from doing purely clinical practice to doing to trying to make sure that we change the whole pathway for all patients feels like a really big challenge that not that many people focus on, I think.
Yeah, totally. And I love that you reframe from using the word just to pure clinical practice. but I mean, that's always the point. And I mean, you're excellent to have people on board who really understand how it's implemented into day-to-day life. And I love how you frame it because it's really a big difference if you have a specialist or if you have somebody working in emergency care, you know, with hundreds of people queuing outside. It's just a completely different way of approaching medical care or healthcare. And it needs different answers when it comes to implementing innovation. So your accelerator has at this point already put, I think, 160, that's the number I found, companies through the system. And there are several hundred contracts and there are 3,500 NHS pilots. Mm. Now, there's so much innovation and I come across so many startups and there's so many people who say, I have been a patient or I have been a doctor and I saw this problem and this is the product I built to solve it. And I always question, okay, can this approach really work? So what is your learning? What separates companies that really scaled from the ones that didn't really work out then in the end?
So I'll take off one of my hats and put on two others. So the one around Digital Health London, which is one of the accelerator programs that we run. Overall, we support early stage companies, mid stage, and then the accelerator focuses on late stage companies which are ready for adoption, usually have been in one place already, but need to scale and go to multiple organizations. So there are a few pitfalls to avoid in that world. The first is that often we see a lot of companies have, in a way, overfitted to their first customer. So they've really got the exact problem that solves just the that particular customer's problem absolutely perfectly. And then they go to the hospital down the road, which has a slightly different catchment population, maybe slightly different IT systems and different providers. And then it's no longer perfect. Yes. And so there's a challenge then for adoption. So what we often encourage companies to do is once they've got their proof of concept, to then try and work with a variety of different providers to solve their problem there. And you've worked in other industries, as have I. It's sort of, if you were doing this in retail, you'd be, if an idea is really good, you'd want to see that it works in, you know, multiple cities and maybe works in an airport environment and an inner city environment and a shopping center environment. So that's the way retail would approach this. And I don't think we necessarily help our companies and innovators to do the same thing, which is, you know, let me introduce, you've got something that looks like a good idea. Let's introduce you to multiple types of organizations and then try and help you to solve the problem that will be have broad generalizability. And that's one of the things that the Digital Health London Accelerator does quite early on. And then I think the second bit is to do with that integration of how the data works, and particularly for digital products, is how will this be implemented? What systems does it need to integrate with? What integration is essential versus a nice to have? And that varies, again, quite a lot operationally, is my perspective on it. It's if you, to my point earlier, if you see a patient with a condition 5% of the time, and there's a platform for it. If it doesn't integrate perfectly, it's not the end of the world. I care more that I can log into it really quickly, find it quickly and log into it quickly, and then I can copy my findings or notes into the system I use for all of my patients. Whereas if it's something that affects 95% of the patients that I see, then I'm really quite keen that it works smoothly and seamlessly as a digital product. And I think the same thing happens with, you know, med devices or with pharma products. It's sort of, there are different approaches, aren't there? Is that what you found, Inga?
Yes. It's really interesting because now my question is, if you need a product that works for everybody, how do you get there? Because there are problems that are so specific very often, and you need to ask questions very differently. And what I always think, you know, when I see pitches or when people approach me with a startup idea, I often say, just, you know, use your Claude or ChatGPT or AI to bring in a McKinsey perspective, which would be, you know, this very strategic, systematic, like market analysis, really understanding, you know, what are different needs and how could a more global approach look like, because it's a kind of really different approach on innovation.
I think so. I don't want to be too overly positive about it. This is one of the areas I think we could improve in the UK a little bit, because I've worked in the US as well and work with colleagues in Germany and Switzerland through the Siana program. Because the NHS in England treats about 90% of patients through its services, and the services are often geographically linked. It's less of a challenge in London. But if you were in a rural area of England, then the service that you get in your local hospital is probably the only one you can provide. We spend quite a lot of time, rightly, thinking about how do we address health inequalities? How do we make sure that everybody can access the services in an equitable manner in an equal way? And that sometimes means that we are more thoughtful and slower about adopting new innovations, because we think, well, it isn't yet at the stage where everybody will benefit from it, therefore we won't roll it out for all our patients yet. Whereas if we're in economies that have a bigger private provider landscape or a mixed provider landscape, and in Germany, you know, where there are individual providers with a single insurance system, then there's a bit more emphasis on making sure that you provide a really good service and provide something different to the person next to you, and work through. Now, one of the advantages for us working in London is that we have all of the data that is generated through particularly all of the NHS work available to us through the One London data program, which means that if we put in a new approach to treatment, a new pathway, a new product, we can see whether or not that is having a differential impact on different groups, be it based on where they live, on socioeconomic grounds, on ethnicity, on gender. These are all things that we can look to see who is accessing that service. And there are kind of two examples which jump out immediately for me. So one is whenever we talk about digital services, people get anxious that maybe this will mean that people who don't have access to unlimited smartphone data and are paying on a metered basis get left behind, or people who are less digitally literate or older access those services less. And it gives us an option to say, well, actually, as part of the rollout and piloting of a product, why don't we look at who is using it, who's getting left behind, rather than trying to speculate on it? Obviously, we do a design as well as we can.
Yeah. Question: If you can see who is using the service, can you also in all the data, can you see the benefit? Because if an innovator now can within your network prove the value once, they can be recognized as an innovator across London and get reimbursement, and you got every buyer, you know, in the capital in to accept, well, somebody else's homework. So how do you measure that?
So you've hit the nail exactly on the head. And this is one of the key bits, which is we can do that because we can look at all the usage data across London and build a health economic case from it. Alongside that, that population is actually often quite diverse from an ethnicity point of view and from a socioeconomic point of view. In South London, we have some of the richest and the poorest neighbourhoods in London. And we have over 60% of people in London identify as not being white British. So it's a very diverse population. And therefore, demonstrating that value in our environment translates across to the rest of London, the rest of the UK, and actually internationally quite well. So that's the power of using that data approach. I have to say, with my other hats on, so you mentioned that I was CIO and CITO at an NHS trust, and I was also COO at a trust before. I'm very skeptical when vendors come to me with their own data, which has not been independently validated. I always used to be, because people come with a sales pitch and you kind of, that has its value, but it's nice to have some independent validation of it. And so that's part of the reason that we either do evaluations ourselves or point to universities in London who can do an evaluation for you on a kind of independent basis, because it's much more powerful to have information about efficacy, health economics, patient experience, which has been independently validated, than the company comes and says, oh, 9 out of 10 of our customers were happy and happy with the product. And then you say, well, how reflective are your customers of the general population?
And that's so interesting, because, I mean, then also, even in the NHS, there are really numbers that are super promising. For example, if we look at what I find interesting in the NHS are virtual wards. And they say nearly £2,000 per patient versus a hospital bed. And they still struggled to scale, well, until someone built a cost model or like ambient voice technology, where we see really a quarter more time with patients or even more, you know. So there are numbers already. So what is still standing between trial and then consulting every patient with that kind of, you know, technology?
So I think we've spoken a little bit in various bits of this conversation about the importance of health economics in all of this. And a health economics analysis will always compare, as you know, will compare a new system of care versus something else. You can only ever compare one thing with another. And so often that needs to be done a little bit locally. And if I draw some of the differences for ambient voice technology, which we've just run the largest procurement of ambient voice technology in the UK in South London, doing the whole of South West London in one go, so 20,000 clinicians accessing. The business case in Europe is quite different to the business case in the US, and in the UK particularly, I think, because in the US, people had adopted electronic health records early and were spending quite a lot of time inputting data. And the argument was, if I give you less time to input data, you as a clinician can earn more money seeing more patients, and it's less stressful. So, and what we had seen in the US was that the clinicians were often employing somebody else to input the data for them. So they had real human scribes entering data, and they were then replaced by an AI scribe, which covered it. So in the US, ambient voice technologies are usually called AI scribes. But in the UK, we have a much lighter way of documenting, which is design, you know, I want to document for the benefit of the patient and for the benefit of the next clinician to see the patient, or me in 3 months' time when I see the patient. So we particularly don't document as many negative findings. It's very similar to in Germany, I think. We're much more judicious about what we put in. So the business case doesn't stack up to the same value as in the US. So in the US, I think they were Microsoft, when they launched their DAX product, were charging several hundred pounds per clinician per month, because that's the value, and you're paid per patient. In the UK, the clinicians are not paid per patient. They're paid on a salary basis and employed by an organization. And so then you've got to say, well, actually, what am I adding? I'm adding quality to the note that's produced. I'm giving it to the patient sooner. So actually, if I'm a patient and I walk home with the note that summarized the consultation, that has some value. It can be shared more quickly with the next setting of care and, you know, maybe remove a day or two's worth of time for dictation. It improves the experience of the clinician who's actually doing the consultation. The patients, what we found was that one of the huge values was that the clinician actually spends time looking at the patient.
Yes.
You know, I'm listening and speaking to you, right? I'm not looking at my computer off to the side. All of those things have a value associated with them that we can work through and then work out what the business case is against it.
And yeah, brings us back to what you initially said. You need to start with a problem that the healthcare system really has and might be different just from the setup, just from the processes that we have installed and that are people, used to. And even the business model, you know, that a system is running on. So that's really an interesting example.
If I pick that up, that's the ambient voice technology is another great example of that as well. Because there's a disconnect between what the vendor might want to do and a producer of the system versus what the health system might want to do. So when the first three products were launched in the UK, all three of the vendors for them wanted them to be rolled out in an outpatient environment for outpatient clinics. Because then you're saying, well, I've got this AI scribe which is working on a microphone. I want to be sure that the quality is good. So if it's in a quiet room environment, then that's probably a good place to be doing it and the product will work well. But as a health system, we were saying, well, this probably has the most value in accident and emergency, where you're seeing lots of patients one after another and you've got to document quickly and someone else is going to use that note very shortly afterwards. So we ran our pilots in this in eight different sites in London with a single product. And we tested it in a variety of environments. So ambulances, in the back of an ambulance in someone's home, in the accident and emergency department, in mental health, in general practice, in outpatient departments. And we ran it across all of those systems to say, well, actually, where is the benefit greatest to our system rather than the product, you know, that meets the acceptable quality standard for this product? And that is a different approach to implementation than you would get if a vendor was saying, I want to roll my product out and these are the places I think it adds, you know, safest to roll it out.
Yeah.
So that's why I get excited.
I had a podcast with one of the vendors in the NHS, Heidi Health, and they just told me that they launched a portable microphone toolkit that can work in emergency environments. Yeah, which then closed the cycle. I mean, that's kind of interesting. I have another question.
Just from the spirit of like, how can the system be better at this? Mm-hmm. In choosing to do that with a single product across multiple settings, it gave us comparability of where it's useful. And then the onus is on the system we tested it with was not Heidi. But then the onus moves to the new providers coming in to say, well, my system works in an accident and emergency as well, doesn't it? Because otherwise, when you go out to procurement, you're saying, well, that company has evidence that it works in all these environments. Where's your evidence? So we can, as a health system, we can adapt what products are developed for our benefit, can't we? Which is, I think, a useful way forwards.
Yes, you can. And then, I mean, you already mentioned from the three things that you are providing or that you are solving, one is reimbursement. And you mentioned DiGA, that apps on prescription, digitale Gesundheitsanwendungen, as we call it in Germany. And Germany was actually the first company building that reimbursement fast track. But the adoption totally disappoints. And in practice, it has become really difficult for vendors to go through that process. And England and the UK has no such pathway, but scales much better in pockets. So what does this paradox tell you? I'm asking.
Well, that's a really, really interesting one, isn't it? And we're quite keen because I think you're probably about 18 months to 2 years ahead of us. And you've been through one cycle of products at the end of their 18-month period having to be continued or not continued. And I understand a lot fell over at that point. I think, first off, I think it is helpful to have a standard way of prescribing digital health products. And we have some requirements in London around if we're choosing to prescribe products. We currently don't have a single way of doing it, but we have four ways of doing it across London, about across the 10 million people. So they're not inconsiderable sizes of markets. We have a single way of validating and regulating the products, but we don't have the reimbursement model exactly the same. So that gives a bit of local scope to selecting products to roll out. The second bit, I think, is that we're quite clear that for the products that go down that route, we need to be able to get the data back into the London system, so that one London platform, because otherwise we can't really do comparisons of how the usage of the product is over time, how long they continue to use. So one is that it has to feed data back into one London. And then the one that we're trying to add now, but it's taken a little bit longer, is that we have a single NHS app which authenticates the patient as well. That means that it's a little bit like an insurer's health platform, but with a lot of functionality in it. It means that that will then let us identify which patients would benefit from particular products. So those things together are the bits that we're hoping to do differently. But we're certainly looking, or have been looking, at DiGA as a route to what should we learn and what pitfalls there are. I have a long-standing piece, and we'll come into innovation strategy in this, but there really is a second mover advantage in a lot of these things. So people always talk about the first mover advantage, but going second means you get to see what others have learned from what others have done.
Yeah, I think in healthcare, the second mover advantage is totally real. And also, I mean, it helps to have an overall strategy with an overall goal that you want to achieve, because just having digital therapeutics is not helping anything if they are not integrated in an overall plan, and if they're just seen or perceived as a cost factor. And that's kind of happened in Germany a little bit, even though when you compare them with other medication or therapies, it's like a tiny number. But still, all these, I mean, having this one strategy and this one bold vision and goal is really, from my point of view, the key to then sort what kind of innovation do you want to integrate and how, and what kind of data does this innovation need to deliver. So
I think what you're describing is really important. A lot of the digital health platforms that came early were about long-term condition self-management, and it wasn't linked to what is the impact on my accessing of healthcare providers and medicines elsewhere in the system. And I would compare that with something like one of the companies that went through our accelerator a couple of years ago is called Flock Health, which did an AI-based physiotherapy for back pain. And really what they demonstrated is that they could see over 90% of patients without them seeing a physical human physiotherapist. And it reduced the number of appointments that were needed. And therefore, that's where the value is generated. But again, a lot of this comes back to health economics, doesn't it? So I wish that back at... if I had known now what I know then, maybe I'd have done a health economics degree back then.
Mm-hmm. Yes, makes total sense.
That's what I'm telling my children.
Yes, combine both. I mean, even when you, maybe not in the NHS, but when you work when you have your own practice, you need to have, like, even if you're a doctor, you need to understand health economics. But you also need, and that's what I learned really from this conversation, you need the broader perspective. You need to have the data, and you need to look at the processes independently from the little brick, the organizational brick you're in within the whole system during the patient journey, whether it's a clinic or it's even a prison or an elderly care or whatsoever. And that's what I find really, really interesting, like bringing all these stakeholders together and then being able, you know, as an accelerator, as a network, as an innovation network, really opening all the doors to, you know, the different stages in this journey. And that's super interesting. Do you think we will see a UK innovation zone or a European innovation zone? We will see that in the next couple of years more, having these like sandboxes. It's almost like a sandbox.
I think we are, and I think we're already beginning to see that in some places. So creation of single data sets that you can test on and model whether your product works well are happening in the UK, but they're also happening in other parts of Europe and particularly places where they have good data sets. Denmark and Estonia have kind of always come to the top of the list when you talk about it. I think the second bit that really makes it work well across Europe is the fact that there's a single regulatory system for the products. So when meeting the, you know, digital standards and the regulatory agencies' standards, having that unified across Europe, and the UK is actually very similar in many ways, is really helpful as well. I think the bit that is perhaps more challenging to get to a single platform is this difference in the health systems themselves. The delivery systems means that the health economics are somewhat different in each geography that you go to. And also I think that there's a difference in the emphasis that we place on different areas. So as we've both talked about it, and we both design and build products as well, I think our language shifts towards processes and how we think about the operations of it. Definitely. And if we were in a retail environment, we'd be talking about patient experience and clinician experience. And if we're balancing that, we'd also talk about risk and who, you know, what risk is there and how is that mitigated and worked through. And one of the things that I think we're facing a lot in the UK that has slowed innovation and the spread of things is that a lot of the risks that appear are technical risks. But a lot of the mitigations for those risks are operational processes. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to develop a product requires the person who's adopting the product to build their operational processes in a way that mitigate those risks. And what I've seen quite a lot of more recently, is individual providers setting up to take on and deliver a service so that it's not just a product on its own, it's a product plus the wraparound care, which means that you've got a safe service as a whole rather than thinking in terms of safe products. And that's a very different, big difference between pharma medical devices and digital health. And I think that's where I get excited, is that the broad thing for spread and development of products is really well set up because we've had common processes for pharma and medical devices for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. And the sophistication that we're building in many places around Europe, London being one of them, but not the only one, around how do we develop those safe systems around it and how do we spread those systems is what gives me a lot of hope for the future. So I hope that we're here in 2 years' time talking about how massive successes in all these areas.
Yeah, thank you so much for this optimistic outlook. I am really looking forward to meeting you at the Health Europe conference. And it was super interesting.
And I think I'm talking about the dullest topic that's there, right? Which is about adoption. So if anyone else is there, then, you know, see you next week.
Yeah, that's the headline you got. So, so I don't think so. I think implementation is really crucial and super interesting, and also most challenging. So thank you so, so much for the conversation. And good luck for everything to come.
Great. And it's lovely to have a chance to speak with you today, and I look forward to seeing you next week.